Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is one of my personal favorite contemporary writers, Manuel Paul Lopez, and I hesitate to call him a poet. Although he is very much a poet, he's also a writer of great and wide and far-ranging experimentation. He writes screenplays and short stories and just a lot of great things. And, you know, I can't say enough about Paul because there are a lot of wonderful emerging writers coming out right now all across the landscape. And, you know, a lot of them take on very serious topics and concerns of the day. But typically that approach is always a kind of either a somber in tone or very serious in tone. And it's hard for a writer to, I think, strike a balance between topical concerns that are serious with humor and wit and also bold experimentation all in one. And Paul Lopez's work has always done that. And that's one of the reasons he's actually one of my favorite contemporary writers. So needless to say, I'm really looking forward to this conversation, and it's coming up right now. Stick around. Manuel Paul Lopez's books and chapbook include The Yearning Feed, 1984, and Death of a Mexican and Other Poems. He co-edited Reclaiming Our Stories, Narratives of Identity, Resilience, and Empowerment. He is a Canto Mundo Fellow, and his work has been widely published in places like the Bilingual Review, the Denver Quarterly, Huizache, and many others. His work has been supported by the San Diego Foundation's Creative Catalyst Fund, and he lives in San Diego and teaches there in San Diego at City College. Paul Lopez, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, Tim. Thank you so much.
Hey, congratulations on this excellent new book, man. I'm such a fan of your work, and this book is just one more gem to add to the collection.
Thank you very much, man. I really appreciate that. I'm very excited. It's a totally surreal experience I'm feeling right now. But it's been great.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, you know, and I've said this before, but you really are one of my favorite contemporary poets out there. And throughout this interview, I'm going to explain to you why. Hopefully, I'll demonstrate why that is. But this book really, to me, encapsulates all the reasons why. One of them, though, is that your creative volume is always like turned up to full throttle, always on every one of your books. And I read it, and it's unexpected from book to book, from page to page. And it's just, you know, I better stop because we won't have anything left to talk about. So, you know, your last book was called The Yearning Feed, right?
Yes. 2013 is when it was published.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 2013 through University of Notre Dame Press.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, you know what? Before we jump into the interview, why don't we start this off by having you read a selection from your book for our listeners? And the book is titled These Days of Candy.
First, Tim, again, thanks so much. And thank you for those wonderful words. I want to begin with the epigraph for the book that begins the book by Frank Lima, and it is, "My heart is the shyest object in the world." Mm. The first piece is The Day of a Stenographer, and it's on page 5. 1. A stenographer ought to regulate his life. Here is the exact timetable of my daily life. Get up 5:35 a.m., bewildered, from 6 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., eat lunch 12 p.m., eat only foods that resemble interplanetary forms wedded in genuflection. Examine shadows throughout the day. Carry thermometer in breast pocket that bears all and consumes all. From 1 to 2:25 p.m., subscribe to hundreds of tabloids from around the world and cancel every last one of them the very next day. Walk from 2:20 to 3:30 p.m. and daydream a rigorous Bobby Desnos poem while embracing the harrowing fear of all sense of self. My ballpoint is incredibly impressionable. 3:32 to 4:28 p.m. fast and dine on the clarity to which hunger can only give rise. 4:30 to 6:28 remain intemperate in the halls of memory that thump their sick song while stenographing a fevered description of a sun burnishing the last gasp of day. Eat dinner standing on one leg. My food must be shelled, reshelled, and shelled again, using everyday household fixers, a process repeated ad nauseum until there is nothing visibly left of the organism but a ball of tape, thumbtacks, thread, and various coats of glue. This is a performance of small-scale wreckage. This is an elegy for environmental heartbreak. A stenographer must be a seasoned performance artist. A stenographer must toil without fear, regardless of what's at stake. After dinner, another walk. It must never exceed 2,011 steps because the Maya should never be mocked. Read late into the evening something delicious like Aristas et tu raza. Sleep at an undisclosed time and listen to Satie. 2. Our shadows speak. Our shadows conspire with cathedrals in the sky. Our shadows paint intricate murals with wild hands and glass spinnerets. Our shadows are full-grown water barrels left to fairy tale giants with grass slippers to drink from. The row is a shadow. The shadowed cathedral is a transmutation of early 20th century jazz musicians. Frida is a shadow. When I measured my heart, it weighed 368 kilograms. I stenographed no, but the world did not listen. The cardiologist did not listen. I threatened my pericardium with a hand shovel if it didn't drop weight. By nightfall, I was heartless. By nightfall, I was a shadow's shadow. In my dreams, I stenographed the shaky manifesto of solitude and isolation, the shadow's shadow song. Who do you stenograph for? The old stenographer asked the young stenographer. Who do I stenograph for? I stenograph for the public record, the young stenographer responded. Isn't that our purpose? I mean, who do you stenograph for? He asked. I stenograph for God, the old stenographer answered. The young stenographer dropped his shoulders and mumbled something about better to become a poet as he walked away into the night, shaking his head. Your real imagination, that's what your grandmother always said. A real imagination, Mijito, no. Keep stenographing your big heart away because the world needs to change with beauty in mind. The stenographer just transcribed a wild man with lots of hair who thought writing an entire novel without using the letter E would amuse his future selves. In response, the stenographer laughed at the challenge and stenographed the entire trial without using the letters O and J. Many blame the release of the defendant on this particularly short-sighted and sloppy artistic constraint. 6. Use your stenography to embody everything you can think of, if you'll urge. He said, even if it's fundamentally wrong, do it. Do it because it's your freedom as a stenographer to do it. But what will people think of me for you? People won't think anything of you because your perceptions are shitty and unfathomably opaque. Believe me, Mijo, the harm or damage you possibly cause is minimal at best. Me, on the other hand, I'm a different story entirely, my boy. 7. In court, the stenographer is an unwavering crime capsule. In court, the stenographer is an oncologist hemorrhaging ears. In court, the stenographer is a rascal satirist bricklaying incendiary counts against the state in the name of stenography.
Mm. And that is the voice of Manuel Paul Lopez reading from his new book, These Days of Candy. What a wonderful way to kick off this whole collection. Paul, you know, and I wanted to ask you, why start this whole collection off with the voice of a stenographer?
It's someone who's capturing the record, the public record, you know.
Right.
And its true origins actually came from me being called in for jury duty and sitting there and being, you know, selected for a trial and just kind of watching everything unfold in front of me and watching, you know, the formalities and how this person just sits there and, you know, watching the bailiff, watching the people with me and the jurors and just how that whole scene, you know, kind of unfolds in front of you. And regardless of what time we're in, you know, that record will remain telling its story.
Right. And, you know, and I wondered also, I couldn't help but wonder, I mean, because I questioned that at first, because that's the first piece we get in the collection. And then after I read the whole collection, I went back to that piece again. And then one of the first questions that came to me was, you know, how much of Paul Lopez is the stenographer?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And I mean, and I asked that because because the old stenographer says, I stenograph for God. And the young one says, you know, it's for public record. You know, so I wonder, that's what made me kind of prompted that question.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just learning the apprentice, taking everything in. There's certainly a lot of interesting people in my family and friends, and a lot of that kind of comes through, you know, especially the Theo. And a lot of that is, I mean, it's the imagination. Learning this thing that I love to do, and constantly learning and just observing and getting things documented.
And, you know, I have observed you observing, so I can tell our listeners for a fact that you, no kidding, hands down, probably one of the best observers I have ever witnessed, I have ever observed. You really are, you know, Paul. I mean, you sit there, I mean, we could be in the middle of a group of people and, or, you know, before a crowd, an audience or something, and you're observing. You're 9 out of 10 times I look at you and you're not like, you know, yapping away at something. You're observing things, you know? So I observe you observing.
But I'm not dutifully, you know, copying everything down people say, but, you know, part of it is that, you know, inner shyness that I still carry with me since I was a little kid, you know, and the introvert that I am. It's not, you know, so that's obviously part of it, you know, and that kind of points to the Frank Lima epigraph at the beginning.
Right.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, that's just me, my nature. I'm usually outside looking in, you know.
And that's honest, and I'm not saying this even, I mean, I'm half joking, but, you know, I've observed you observing, and there's something to that because myself, and it probably goes for a lot of writers, and particularly poets, but a lot of writers, even artists in general, that, you know, there is a sense of either shyness or introvert that offers, that allows us or that affords us this ability to be a constant sort of witness of things evolving around us, you know?
Yeah.
And but even when writers, for example, or artists get into a group of like-minded folks, other writers, and that kind of, you know, then suddenly, like, all the introverts become extroverts, you know? But yet, but you remain true to your introverted roots.
Keeping it real,
keeping it real, that's right. You know, I'm like, look at Paul over there, keeping it real.
no, you know, I mean, yeah, it's just me being me.
Sure, know? No, that's right. And that's a stark contrast, and maybe not at all. You know, as artists, we understand, though, that there's a lot to observing, but that's that kind of quiet nature about you, that observer nature, is in stark contrast to when I open up a book of Manuel Paul Lopez's work. I would expect to, you know, it would be like haikus and, you know, meditations and, you know, but your work is so dynamic and so experimental. And, like, you were not just observing, but you were, like, concocting, like, you know, new ways of thinking. And, you know, I have to say that I'm going to go on a little rant here before I ask you this question, but
okay.
You know, I mean I can't say enough about the potential of creativity that goes into your book. And I know I'm going to say, by the time my listeners are done with listening to this program, they're going to hear that word over and over, that statement there. But, you know, you're like constantly in your work, you're digging and searching for new ways of telling stories, new ways of looking at poetry, new ways of experimenting with language. And, you know, right now, all across the United States, and I imagine the world, that there are these new voices that are emerging on the scene. A lot of them, anyways, are taking on very important topics and concerns, you know, and usually this is often done with a more serious or somber tone, even erudite tone. But I think only once in a while do we get to hear a voice or a poet or writer, whatever you want to call it, that is able to strike this balance between craft, some topical concerns and issues, but inspired, mixed in with, like, humor and experimentation. And one of those rare finds like that to me has always been Juan Felipe Herrera. You know, he's able to just strike that chord of seriousness, and then also in that same breath turn around and laugh at ourselves, you know. And and your work, to me, like, there's a very short list of people who can do that, and you're on that short list, you know. That's
for sure,
you know. So I wanted to ask you, so what first gave you the permission to explore or experiment this way? Was it a book or a person?
There's been, you know, I mean, ever since I was a kid, you know, it's little things, you know, that add to one's formation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And keeps adding to one's formation. But, you know, if I could point to a particular moment, it would be in a class I was taking with Quincy Troop at UCSD, and he gave us the Before Columbus anthology.
Uh-huh.
That's the first time I ever read Juan Felipe Herrera's work.
Mm.
And I was just completely knocked off my feet, you know, with the dynamics, everything that was happening on the page, and just completely kind of spun my head, right?
Yeah.
And then also during that time, Paul Beattie's work, The White Boy Shuffle, which was groundbreaking and just cracked open my head, you know, and just, you know, because there's music, there's art, and just layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, and very, very, you know, great synthesizer, you know, of all sorts of information, just like the other artist, Jean-Michel Basquiat, right?
Right, that's right, yes.
And just taking it all in, and then humor, and then having that scathing critique underneath there, right?
Yes, right.
So, yeah, it was, you know, in the 90s, I guess you would say, the mid-90s, late 90s, during that time, and to see it kind of presented that way, it was very exciting to me.
And, you know, I mean, that's not an easy thing to do for an emerging writer. And I mean, like, I'm familiar with the range of your work. And, you know, it seems to me that you were boldly taking that step and that direction right from the get-go. And I say that because, you know, Juan Felipe was a mentor of mine and very, very close friend. But even then, with all of the experimentations I was exposed to and all that, in my first writing, like, I didn't feel bold enough yet to take those kinds of experimental leaps. And, you know, I came out of the bat with a kind of more traditional form, or even though it was free verse, but more sort of traditional approach to writing poetry out of my first book. But your work has been like this from the beginning. And I thought to myself, you know, how bold for a writer to come out that way. And it's just it seems like a natural fit for you, 'cause as I see your progression, you know.
Uh-huh. again, it's just all of these influences are constantly coming in, and I constantly try to like incorporate and see what happens. It's constant experimentation, you know, and just influenced by things I'm reading, things I'm seeing, things I'm listening to, and you know, so that's where it comes from, and you know, I hope to keep moving that direction.
We're going to unpack some of those things that you just talked about right there that you just mentioned. We'll unpack that in a little bit. But would you mind sharing another poem for us?
Sure. Lulu drew an intersection in her living room with chalk. At least that's what you think. Often wonder why Lulu insists on directing traffic. She's not even good at it. She ripped out the carpet one day despite her family's hollering. Everyone knows when Lulu gets something in that head of hers, there's no turning back, Lulu. That's what we love and fear most about Lulu. An intersection is a point of space that conjoins several possibilities at once. And Lulu, collisions are the markings of time exhaling. Lulu, draw me crosswalks. Lulu, spell stop. Inside the old Lulu drew a happy face, then a sad, sad face. Oh, inspired a confused face. Irony is what the pilgrims say, and if the pilgrims didn't say it, Lulu says they certainly should have. Lulu stresses tragic irony. Lulu also draws mist, and Lulu draws a mist man and a holy mist creator that lurks behind a television set. Nervous shadows with all this noise and all this time to do what they want to do. And what they please to do is make mist, says Lulu. Lulu discovered early in life she needed to direct traffic to save herself. Lulu also discovered in order to achieve this, she needed a uniform and a whistle. For Christmas, Lulu asked her family for white gloves, but they were too angry and ignored Christmas that year altogether. Lulu is a gloveless crossing guard. Lulu is a crossing guard. On occasion, Lulu will shout, danger, danger, I'm a danger ranger. This happens when her family travels at chaotic speed. This happens when road rage seethes from her father's eyes. Last week, Lulu couldn't bear the traffic in her apartment, so she sat cross-legged in the middle of the intersection, covered her ears, and screamed into a whistle. Her whistle sounded like a pathetic hoo-hoo from a sad rain uniform. This is why most believe she is not very good at directing traffic. So why? You're not very good at directing traffic, said the collision course, said the carcass minced with fly droppings. So why? Lulu's intersection is designed with birds, trees, and chinchilla faces and many colored chalk. Though her glyphs are fading these days. These days are fading. These days of candy are fading. Hooray for Lulu. Lulu's intersection is one that unites destruction and birth. Beliefs exist even when no one in the room believes the belief. Lulu is quite an artist, quite a quiet artist. She grits her teeth and art is made. Lulu's teachers always mention these particulars when describing Lulu. Lulu is her name. Lulu drew the Svalbard Global Seed Vault and slept in its embraces for 2 weeks. Lulu sleeps in her intersection. Hooray for life, Lulu. Hooray for Lulu.
And if you are just tuning in, that is the voice of poet Manuel Paul Lopez reading from his new book, These Days of Candy. You know, and I referred to this as a poem when I introduced it in a minute ago, but do you adhere to those kinds of labels? I don't know if I would call this poetry or, you know, some of the book has like, obviously looks like poetry and acts like it, but other times you're going all over the place. So how do you feel about those labels?
I don't really think about them too much, but, yeah, I mean, it takes a little bit from everything, I guess. I mean, there's certainly the narrative and the character and you know, the lyric and all, you know, all of those things in there. But at the end of the day, I just refer to it as a collection of poetry. Because I think poetry itself is that versatile, you know. It's so open, you know, and that's what has me laboring over it and reading as much as I can and devouring as much as I can. And sustaining myself on it, you know?
Right. Yeah, because poetry is very much, it can be very much a narrative. It could be, you know, short story. Mm-hmm. It can be anything, you know?
Yeah.
And so, absolutely. And you take full advantage of that, you know, that's great. One of the things that I was most impressed with throughout the whole collection is your attention to characters. And you have these several fully developed characters, you know, that, I mean, even the speaker is one, for example, in the stenographer, I mean, you know, that's the speaker of that is a very clear, you can almost see and visualize that character. And that's throughout your book, like with this character, Lulu, for example, or one of my favorite characters in the book, the saddest man in Shovel, in the story Shovel. And of course you've got other characters like Mousepad and, you know, he's like, and these strange and interesting characters. But, you know, talk about your characters for a moment. How do you come about them, or how do they find you?
Well, I mean, the characters, I guess I just think that, I mean, most of my stuff is character driven. Mm-hmm. At least it is now, you know. Yeah. Most of them are fighters, you know, fighting against the odds and trying to overcome, you know, the pressures of the system, you know, whatever, the oppressive forces, you know, right. And being bullied by whatever it might be.
Right.
And that's where they get their juice, you know, in that fight.
Right.
Other than that, I mean, I don't know. The saddest man was actually a story when I had a puppy, and he was very ill, and that's where it comes from. My little dog was having a tough time.
Were you the saddest man at that time?
I felt so guilty and just, yeah. So
yes.
That's where that origin, I mean, it's obviously not a true story, but that's where it comes from.
That's
comes
a great
from a
story.
Experience. You know what I'm saying?
Now, the saddest man appears for our listeners. He appears in the story called The Shovel, I believe, or Shovel. And, and you know, it's a hilarious, at first it's kind of depressing, and because he's the saddest man and he's a lonely guy. And then suddenly he's like looking on, he's like scanning Craigslist. And then he sees, my favorite line is he sees these Maltipoos for sale. And he calls the owner and he says, "Are Maltipoos happy, for God's sake? Are they happy? Are they happy dogs?"
Yeah. So
I couldn't stop laughing at that. It was like, I could hear, like, so sad. He's like, "God, for God's sake, is this dog a happy dog? I need one of these."
Please give me the happy dog.
Yeah, please, man. Give me the happy dog.
Yeah. So yeah, that piece needed some, a little bit of comic relief. Yeah, for sure. And it is a strange, unique character out of that story. So
yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah, and then the name Maltipoo is like, you know, it's like, that's just humorous already in contrast to this sad man scanning Craigslist, you know? But writing humor is a really, I mean, for me at least, it's really difficult, you know, but you do it so naturally through your characters. Did you ever have any issue with learning to write humor, or how does that come about for you?
I never really thought about it, and I mean, it just happens that way. Maybe to combat the constant seriousness I kind of walk around with, you know,
right.
or something. But it's just, like I said, going back to Paul Beatty's work and what he was doing with humor, I think that was a major, major point for me to take it in and see what humor can do, you know, and still charge forward with you know, critique and satire. And
yeah.
That, you know, so.
Yes. I was just sharing Paul Beatty's work, one of his work just the other day. Like, I want to say about a week ago, I was just telling, because there's this one funny, I think it's in his first book, Big Bank to Little Bank.
Yeah.
In which he says, why the Laurel and Hardy, who's on first, that never works in the ghetto? He says, and it goes, "Who's on first? Your mama."
<It's>
like, yeah. And so,
yes.
Yeah. Just these quick kind of shots that just are luminous and funny, you know? So,
lightning quick, man. You know what I mean? Just lightning quick. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
Little Bang, Joker Deuce, you know, and White Boy Shuffle.
Yes, right. Joker
books,
Deuce.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. That's the next one. And, you know, so I want to turn... actually, before I go to this next question I want to ask you, there's... do you have any desire to write a kind of more straightforward novel approach to a book, or, you know, are you working on something? And I ask that just because when I was reading your characters and how developed they are, I thought of Amiri Baraka one time when I was I spent some time with him in Boulder, Colorado, one week, and I asked him, I said, "Why did you go from poetry to writing prose?" And he said, "Because all the characters in my poems needed to speak." He said they had something to say. The characters might, because the people in my poems had something to say, and so I had to listen. Uh-huh. And that's how he turned to that. But I was wondering, did you have any aspirations to write a kind of more quote unquote straightforward novel?
Yeah, I mean that urge has come and go. I mean, there's a lot of false starts,
right.
You know, and then you come back to it. I do write short stories. I do write, you know, monologues and things like that. I really would like to write for the stage at some point.
Right.
I've done pieces here and there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do love hearing characters speak and you know, the dialogue, the conversation, you know, all of that and all the possibilities that come through those. So yeah, I mean, again, I'm very character driven and when I'm writing, you know, you hear these voices, you know,
right,
going off in your head and so in terms of writing the novel, I mean, I have no clear sort of thoughts on it now, but you know, right. I'm writing short stories, short fiction.
You know? Yeah, I have no doubt that that would be a possibility for you at all, like an easy transition because you're already doing all that. But you know, and I want to, with the last couple of minutes we have here, I want to also turn my attention now to the anchor poem or the anchor piece of this book, which was, I don't know if I, it kind of looks like a screenplay or a stage play maybe, but it's called These Days of Candy. What would you call this? Was it a screenplay to you, or is it a, you know, and what prompted you to write it?
Yeah, I mean, the idea with the characters are a little fireflies.
Right.
Right. And that comes from a time when I was in El Salvador and I was there with my friend Julio Delgado, staying at his house. And it was a very late night and I saw fireflies for the first time.
Yeah.
And it was this incredible experience and it stayed with me. And then I just, one day, they emerged, you know, out of the screen and they became characters and they started talking to each other. And, and at first it was a very A to Z, you know, chronological story, linear story, right?
Right.
And then and there were pages and pages and pages and pages. And then one day I said, you know, what will happen if I just scramble everything?
Yeah.
You know, and it, I started doing the cut up, you know, that type of thing. And,
right.
And then what would happen if I eliminated the characters so you don't know who's speaking all the time?
Right.
It takes a while to catch on to who's speaking.
Right,
so
it does.
There's multiple voices, and I wanted it to be disorienting. I wanted it to be sort of like shooting off in all sorts of different directions.
Yeah.
And even some of the music that I was listening to at the time now serves as a playlist for the piece with specific directions as to how to incorporate the music as you're meeting it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's one of the things I liked is that you included this playlist at the beginning. And I actually played a couple of the songs while I read it.
Nice.
So I followed the instructions.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
it just served kind of maybe like a movie trailer, I guess you could call it. Some sort of like, so to a no movie, you know, kind of reference Askel. Kind of cinematic, right?
Yeah, very much so. And it also was reminiscent of like a Douglas Adams sort of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of, you know, because it was this kind of almost galactic or universal tone and language that they're using, and it is disorienting. It's its own distinct world, you know. I wouldn't even know how to categorize it, but I enjoyed reading it because it was like the rest of your work, experimental and always unexpected.
It was a lot longer, and I had to trim and go forward again, trim and all of sorts of things. At the time, I was reading a lot of Fernando Arrabal, the Spanish playwright, and that was a huge influence on the work of Jodorowsky.
Yeah,
Alejandro.
Wonderful. Yeah.
You know, so a lot of that stuff was going on, and
great.
At the end of the day, I hope it works.
Well, it certainly does. And you know what? We're out of time, my friend. But you know what? This book, These Days of Candy, that just came out with, Noemi Press, huh?
The Noemi Press.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm so happy. Noemi's been amazing. There's so many great people there.
Yeah, they do good work.
Yeah,
they really do good work. Well, congratulations, Paul. This is a great book, and I hope it goes far, my friend.
Thank you so much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Absolutely. Absolutely. Take care of yourself. We would like to thank our guest today, the brilliant, multifaceted writer, Manuel Paul Lopez. Be sure to pick up his book, These Days of Candy. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our wonderful producer, Lauren Terrazas, and I am Tim Hernandez. And we'll see you next week, same time, same place on KTEP 88.5 FM.